Hello, everybody. My name is Mary Wellborn, and I am a recovering Al-Anon. And first off, I want to tell y'all that I am not nervous, because it's just normal for me to take the cert and chew the aspirin. And that's what I just did. I am not an Al-Anon because I was married to a gentleman who said he was an alcoholic, and I was married to him for 31 years. And 21 years of this, he was in this beautiful program. But that did not make me an Al-Anon. I used to attend open meetings and see people who that was the only place I saw, and they would say, I am an Al-Anon. But I have to work the Al-Anon program, and I have to admit that someone else's drinking has disturbed my life, and work this program and attend meetings and try to work the program in my daily life for me to say that I am an Al-Anon, and I really am one. Without it, I would be dead. I want to thank the committee for asking me here. I've really been looking forward to coming up to this great mountain up here. I've heard so much about it, and I have been up to Lookout Mountain twice, but as I was telling someone the other day, I wasn't at Lookout Mountain looking at the scenery. I was watching him to see that he didn't get a drink. So I don't remember too much about it. But that was in the days gone by. I didn't really have to be doing all these things. I could have been enjoying my life at that time. I'm the perfect person to have been born to started marrying alcoholics, because I was born up here in the little town of, no one has ever heard of it, I know, Rolling Fork, Mississippi. It's in the Delta. Someone has heard of it. I was born into a home that there was no alcohol whatsoever. There were 6 children. I didn't know anything at all about alcohol when I was growing up, except that it was something that the other people did. And this is sad, and I even hate to tell it. If someone's daddy drank, and I never heard of a woman drinking at that time, we weren't allowed to play with them. Now, this is sad, but that's the way it was up there in that Delta section where I was. I had an uncle that once in a while would take a drink at a Christmas party of the family, but when he did, we were herded into the car and taken home, because they weren't going to have us around Uncle Ray when he was drinking. And this is the kind of life, and it was a very religious family. We were Methodists. We attended all of the services, and I felt very safe, and I had a God of my understanding, even when I was a small child. One of my first memories is of having on a little yellow dress with smocking on it, so I couldn't have been over 5 or 6 years old, I wouldn't think, and it had 2 pockets, and I had my hands in my pockets, and it was between Sunday school and church, and I was walking up and down the steps like little girls do, showing off, and the superintendent of the Sunday school that we called Daddy Jones said, Mary, what have you got in your pocket? And I said, I got God in my pocket. And you know, it was wonderful at that, when I think back on it at that age, to feel that safe and secure. And I really did feel that way. I had a loving childhood. I suppose I was a people pleaser then, because we knew that if we did what we were supposed to, everything was fine. And I was a pretty good student, and I graduated from school early. And this is when it all started. I had always felt as though I fitted in, and I was happy with where I was. But when you graduate from high school in a small town, you've got to leave home. You've got to go to school, you've got to get a job, you've got to get married, you've got to do something. I was not equipped to work anywhere. There was no one in sight for me to marry, so I went to school. And you know, you watch this program, it's a different world. Well, it was a different world to me. I had never even seen a woman smoke. Led a protected life. I had never been on a single date. I had been on double dates, but one of the others had to be my brother. This was the kind of life I had led until I was sent off to school. And then here I was all on my own. Of course, I had a page of instructions of do's and don't do's. But as soon as I got there, I developed this disease we all talk about, this disease of dis-ease, and I didn't feel like I fitted in. And I was very sad from the very first day I went in there. I would go to their parties, and I want to tell you AAs in here how lucky you are. I found at that time that if I took a drink, I never did do it but two or three times. It made my whole mouth itch and my teeth itch. I couldn't stand it. So y'all were very lucky, because I've always been told that I would have made a bang-up alcoholic. But I felt on the edge of things. I did not feel a part of. I was not making good grades. And this was during the wartime. I'm just 39. And into this school, I was up at Ole Miss, and into they've sent some maritime officers down for a 3 months course. And of course, these were older men. The one that seemed to pay attention to me was 23 years old, and to a 17-year-old girl, that was an older man. He was tall, he was handsome, he was a brunette, and he had a mustache, and he wore this white uniform. And when he left there with his diploma 3 months later, he had a wife with him, too. I look back on that, and I think how foolish I was. I was getting married to get away from something, so I was starting my running that we've heard about. He was from New Jersey. We went by and he met my parents. I know they were devastated, but bless them, they gave us their blessings and all of these great things and didn't act like their heart was broken, but I know now it was. And we went on up to New Jersey, and I was in for a surprise, but so were his parents. His parents didn't know he had married. And I didn't know he had planned for me to live with them. So we started off with a great boon. As I said, he was in the maritime service, and he was stationed at Perth Amboy. And he went in and out from there. And when he'd go out, you wouldn't know. He might be back in next week. It might be the next month. It might be 6 months. It never was 6 months, but it could have been. And I lived there with his parents, and there was lots of drinking. But they had been drinking up at school, and he had just been like the rest of them. I never thought too much about it. But with them, after dinner, they'd say, let's go down the hill. And we'd go down the hill, and it was a tavern. And they would sit there till 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning drinking. And my Coke would get so hot, I couldn't stand it because I couldn't drink. And I know I was very judgmental. I know I didn't give those people a chance to love me. Nor did I give them myself a chance to love them. I resented them from the moment I walked in the door. They were Yankees. Now, of course, I had married one, but, you know, that didn't count. This was different. And I was up there almost 2 years, and I won't even go into that. It was very unhappy. I did work. I managed to accomplish two things while I was up there. I worked and more or less supported myself. I've decided now that maybe the maritime people don't give people money, because I never did see any money from that husband, I'll tell you. His parents supported me, and I worked, and that was it. And also, I came away with a little boy, a little red-headed boy that really turned my life around. I realized after this child was born that I just couldn't live up there and live like this. And I talked to them about going home, and they told me, no, 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 you can't do that. You've got to stay here. So one day, I went shopping with my shopping bag full of little clothes and a few bottles of milk. And I got myself on a Greyhound bus, and I came back south where I belonged, I thought. My parents welcomed me with open arms, and they told me, they said, you can always have a home here, and we'll help you raise Nelson, and we're so glad you're back. And they helped me to plan my life again. I went back to school, but in the meantime, I had a job. I was very, very fortunate. I got a job with an attorney. And all these long years since then, I've worked for an attorney. So see, God was taking care of me even then. I remember that, and I hadn't been back very long. I don't know how long, but they laid down some ground rules when I moved back in. I could have no contact with him whatsoever, by telephone, by letter, or if he came, he would be run out of town. And that was the ground rules for me being there. And I didn't hear anything about whether he called or anything at all until several months later. And my parents called me in one day and told me that they had a call from up there and that he had expired 3 months before from a car accident. And I was that long knowing it. I had some resentments at one time about that, but I'm through with those. You know, God does for us what we can't do for ourselves. And my parents, who had laid down these ground rules, had also said that under no circumstances could I get a divorce. They didn't want me to see him or anything, but I couldn't get a divorce because no one in our family had ever had a divorce. And I would not be the first one and disgrace them any farther than I had. So, of course, but I was relieved of that burden by God. I mean, I'm sorry, I have to think of it that way. This is just how it happened. I started going out a little bit, but I would go out with someone. If they had a beer, forget it. Never again. Well, it didn't take me long to go through the eligible men in that town, and I moved to Memphis. I mean, I had decided that I didn't think that I needed a husband, but I thought my little boy needed a father, and I was going to get out and find him one. And I found one, and this man did not drink. He had had a very unhappy experience with his wife, an alcoholic, and he had a little boy 3 months younger than mine. And, you know, we were very sensible people. Here I was being sensible again. So we became engaged, and we were going to kind of get our families used to one another. And things were going on pretty good, and he worked for the railroad, and there was a strike. And he was a very ambitious person. And he got him a job immediately, almost, as a bill clerk with a motor freight line. And every night when he'd come by the house, I'd have to listen to what his boss did. He said he is a charming man. Said he has all this personality and he's so smart. Said, but you know, he keeps vodka in his bottom drawer, and when he drinks coffee, he puts vodka in it. Well, I'm not gonna bore y'all with the details, but I married the man that put the vodka in his coffee. When I saw him, I immediately knew this was the man I wanted. And I had never felt like that about anyone else, in spite of having been married and engaged. I mean, there was just something about this man that appealed to me. He was kind, he was good to the child, and the child loved him. And he was very generous, and he was intelligent. And I don't know, you ladies probably understand what I mean, but he was the one I wanted. And sure enough, we got married. And I was going to marry this man and make him so happy he would never drink again, because I didn't feel like I could marry him and say, stop drinking, because I married him drinking. And he drank a lot. Many times I've had to drive home and leave his car in his garage and walk 6 blocks at 2 o'clock in the morning to get home and leave him in his car sleeping. But, you know, I was going to change all of this. And sure enough, we hadn't been married very long. He came in one night with a six-pack of Coke instead of the usual six-pack of beer. And he said, you know what? I'm not ever going to take another drink. He said, I have responsibilities now. I have a family. I want to grow up in my job. We want to buy us a house. And I'm not ever going to take another drink ever, ever again. And I thought, look what I have done. We have made him so happy, because it was a matter of we married him. We have made him so happy that he's never going to drink again. And for 5 years, he didn't. But I walked on eggs. We lost all of our friends, because only people we knew were people that drank. And then this is when I started my controlling first. You know, if they called and asked us somewhere, I'd tell them we couldn't go, but I wouldn't even tell him. You know, I was afraid we'd go and he'd have a drink. And it was pathetic, the life we led. We took our bodies to the Catholic Church because we were raising our child a Catholic, and he was in Catholic school, and we joined the men's club and the ladies' club at the Catholic, and this was the only people we associated with, but I found out that they drank a lot, and I backed off from that. You know, I didn't want to expose him. I was keeping him, and we did a lot of traveling hither and yon, and we enjoyed those 5 years. But all this time, there was this fear inside of me, and that he would start drinking again, and it would be my fault. And lo and behold, guess what? He started drinking again. And when he did, I was completely devastated. I was so frightened. I'll never forget how I felt when I saw him pick up that first bottle of beer, for something told me that, you know, this is all she wrote. And I didn't want anything. I didn't want to leave this man. I, I, what I wanted was him to sober up, and I didn't know how to make him do it. And so what have I done to make him drink? This is what I would tell myself, and I tried everything. Many a morning at 2 o'clock, I would be waxing the kitchen floor so he'd think I was smart and stop drinking. Now, that's good sense. Of course, he lost his job. Normally he was a periodic, but this time the time ran for 13 months. And it was 13 months that we lost a house, we lost our car, he lost his jobs. He kept, you know, adjusting down to lower jobs. And at last he couldn't get one in Memphis. And we were sitting in Memphis waiting on our son to graduate from Immaculate Conception in the 8th grade, because we didn't want to take him out of school at the end of the thing. And how we managed that, I don't know. He had more to do with managing of it than I did, because I was a completely wild person. This disease of disease had caught up with me. I did not feel comfortable anywhere. Nothing suited me. I was a good cane raiser. Now, he was a real calm sort of person. And this is when I learned about blackouts. I never was really sure about blackouts till I heard some of you people talking, but I did find out that I could tell him that things happened the night before that didn't, and he'd believe me. And I played on that. You know, these breakfast conversations would be real good. I could tell him, well, you look pretty good for what happened last night. You know, he'd say, what happened? You don't know? I said, well, I'm not going to tell you. And then he'd start begging me to tell him. Well, I couldn't even think of anything to tell him. And then he'd be real quiet for a while. And now I feel so sorry that I did this, but I did. And he'd say, honey, I'm so sorry. I'm really sorry. I said, don't worry. It's all right. You know, it's all right. And then 5 minutes later, I'd bring it back up again. I just couldn't stand him to get that look off his face of guilt. I wanted it on there. It made me happy. It made my day. And he got this job in, he got a job in Dallas, and they transferred us. See, God looks out for me when I can't look out for myself. I have to back up just 1 minute. I have to tell this because to me it's so important. When I was back in Greenwood in this little town with playing the part of the widow, I'll never forget it. I had my little child by the hand, and I met Daddy Jones in the post office, who I'd seen in Sunday school. And he said, oh, Mary, says, I'm so sorry. He said, I hear you're having all these problems, baby, and I'm so sorry. He says, but you know, you're going to be all right, because you have God in your pocket. And just for a minute there, I remembered how it used to be to have God in our pocket. But I no longer had God in my pocket, and it was not God's fault. You know, when I'm far away from God now, which I do get sometimes, it's not God that's moved, it's me. And I don't suppose I had any spiritual feelings at all at that time. I thought God had abandoned me and I didn't want to call his attention to me. Still, I was going to church because we wanted to do the right thing. You know, the Joneses went to church and the Smiths went to church. Well, the Wellborns did too. I have taken my poor husband to church at night on an Easter when our child was going to be an altar boy. When he was in such a bad shape that the Catholics know how they come on Easter and sprinkle you in the audience, and he threw a whole dipper full of water in Neil's face to wake him up. And I was embarrassed. I hadn't done anything to cause this. I'd merely dragged him there when he would have been perfectly happy just to lay on the couch at home. But when we went to Midland, things kind of changed. He didn't drink for quite a while, and our child was growing up, and I didn't have viruses to say he had. He always had to have pneumonia when he was recovering. And Nelson was at the point where he did not believe that he had pneumonia all the time. And Neil lost his job there. But God looked out for us. I was working and I had a good job. And a lot of funny things happened. He was a salesman, an independent salesman by then. Now, I don't know if any of y'all have ever been independent salesmen, but you get your own product and you sell it, and if you make money, fine. If you don't, fine. And he was going from one product to the other at this time. And he was had been out of a product for a couple of months, and he was kind of sobering up, I thought. Generally, you know, I thought I could look at him and tell how far along he was. You know, he has this many more drinking days or something. And he would lay in that back room and not bother a soul. And I would go to work, and I'd come home, and he'd still be in the same condition. And I would have looked the house over, and I poured out everything I found, and I trained my child to do that. And you look good. And we would pour it out. But one day I went home at noon for some reason, and I hadn't been there long, and the doorbell rang, and here was a taxi driver with something in his hand. And I wasn't too smart there for a few minutes, and I said, "You're at the wrong place." He says, "Is this so and such address?" And I said, "Yes." He says, "Well," and then he put this package behind him, and he got real nervous, and I realized that he was delivering something for him to drink. And I went out, and I told the whole neighborhood, I said, "Don't you ever come back, even on this street again." I wasn't going to have him bringing whiskey when my husband ordered it to the house. Of course, there was a law against it, and I had no problems there. But this particular time I was talking about, he was going to see about a job, and I took the day off to go with him because I was going to watch him and be sure he got there in good shape. I didn't want him to stop and have anything to drink on the way. And, you know, that's a wifely duty. You go and you watch him. And all this long time, he could drink whether I was watching him or not. I don't know why I didn't ever get smart enough to realize that. But this particular time, we stopped. There was a little old roadhouse-looking place on the side of the road. And he says, "Let's stop here and get us a cup of coffee." And I thought, that's a funny place to get a cup of coffee. But he had dressed up in his little three-piece suit that morning, and I had dressed up. You know, he pushed the button. Whatever he did, I did. And we went in. Of course, as soon as we sat down, he ordered two cups of coffee like a gentleman. He says, "Got to go to the boys' room." And he got up and went. I know now he was going in there to fortify himself for the rest of his trip. But I didn't really know that at this time. But he came back out and sat down at the table. And about the time he did, here came this poor old drunk over, just staggering. And he says, "I know ye." And Neil straightened up real straight. And he says, "I'm in politics." We weren't even registered to vote. And do you know, I didn't think my husband's lying. I didn't think he's gone in there and had a drink. I didn't think he's been in here before. That's why that man knows him. Do you all know what I thought? How does a senator's wife act? And I straightened my back up. But there was nothing wrong with me. Nothing at all. And our life went on like this for quite some time. And he would stop drinking and work a while, and then he'd drink. And I played Florence Nightingale, and I won't bore y'all with all the details because what I really want to tell you is what it's like now. But I can remember that he would go in that back room, and he would be in there for days at a time. And I would go in, and he had to have some nourishment, and that's the wife's duty. And I would fix orange juice and Cairo syrup. And I'd beat it up together, and bless him, he'd drink it. And then, you know, it'd all come back up. And that was good because it gave me something to do for about 2 hours. I could strip the bed, change his clothes, wash the clothes, and it kept me busy. So, you know, something good comes out of everything. But I was really trying to do my wife a duty. Then one night I was sitting in the hall in my favorite place. I could see his bedroom and him there. I could see my child studying here. And I sat here and, quote, read. The book might be upside down, but this was the condition I was in by this time. And I heard my child on the phone. And I will tell you both sides of the conversation because at the time it didn't make any sense to me. But this little girl said, "Nelson, you sure do sound down." He said, "I am." "Well, what's the matter?" She says, "Well, my dad's leaning on the bed drunk, and my mother's sitting in the hall crying." She says, "Is your father an alcoholic?" And he says, "I think he is." She says, "Goody, goody, my mother and daddy are both alcoholics." And they were in AA, and she was in Alateen. And she invited him to go to Alateen, and I could hear all of this, him making some plans and all by himself without consulting me. I could hear him. But when he came in, I was all prepared to tell him he couldn't do this. But this young man was growing up, and he looked me right in the eye, and he said, "Mom, I think Dad is an alcoholic. And I've been talking to Patty, and her mother and daddy are alcoholics," and said he could go to AA, but even if he can't, I want to go to Alateen. And, you know, something crossed my mind, God looking out for me. I thought, good. I said, "How often would you go?" He said, "One night a week." And I thought, good. That's one night a week where I will know, have my thumb on him, and I'll know where he is, and he'll give me more time to take care of Neil. You know, this made sense. I said, "Well, I'll see that you get the car, but there is a condition. You cannot tell your daddy you're going to Alateen. We'll have to think of something else, because I don't want to hurt his feelings by making him think we think he's an alcoholic." So my son started going to Alateen, and I got a few calls asking me to go to Al-Anon, and I thought, well, I will wait. Any good mother would go down and see what was going on with her child. But I never got around to that because it was the summertime, and we had been off on the 4th of July to a picnic, to a camp thing over the weekend, and Neil hadn't had anything to drink in a long time. In, you know, 3 or 4 months, that was a long time then. And he had started drinking then, and I knew that, you know, it would be a week, 10 days, something like that. But I didn't, you know, everything was fine. That's, you know, what y'all tell people, everything was fine. But when he got up that morning, he told me he had to go to Big Spring, and I said, "Well, you get Nelson up and take Nelson with you." I said, "Because I don't want him running the streets here in Midland and getting in any trouble." And he was a good kid. And Neil knew why I was doing it. Nelson knew why I was doing it. See, we played these games. But he got him up, and he went to Big Springs with him. Well, I'll have to tell their story here because it's God's work again. When he got almost to Big Springs, Nelson said, "Dad, turn off over here and turn here and turn here." He says, "I'm going to go over and see Mary Beth." He says, "Who is Mary Beth, and where did you meet her?" He says, "I met her at Future Teachers." See, that's why he was going on Monday nights. "I met her at Future Teachers, and I'll visit with her while you take care of your business, and you can pick me up." If I had known he was going to do that, I'd have shot him, because I didn't, it just, the very idea. Neil says he does not know how he got back to pick that child up, but he picked him up, and the next I heard from him was Nelson called me on the phone. I was at work, and he said, "Mom," he says, "Dad's drunk. He's in there on the bed. And I'm calling AA to come to him because they told me that if I would call them, they would come out." And I started out with all these reasons not to, and he hung up. I tried to call him back, and the line was busy. I couldn't get him. And all I could think of was, what did I do with the coffee cups this morning? When did I last vacuum? You know, all these important things, you know, if someone was going to go to my house. And I flew home as quickly as I could, and when I got there, there was a note on the door that said, "I've gone to get Patty." Well, that's this little girl. And I went in, and Neil was really pathetic, because I loved this man. Even when he was drunk, I loved him. See how sick I was? And I thought, I really did. I think I prayed at that time. I said, "God, just take care of him." And I suppose maybe I was beginning to realize that I was powerless. I don't know. We go just so far sometimes, and we can't go any farther. But if anyone had asked me that day how things were at our house, I would have normally said, "Fine." But the phone rang, and it was Patty's mother. And she had talked to me a couple of times on the phone before. And she says, "Mary, is Patty there?" And I said, "No, she isn't." I said, "But Nelson's gone over to get her." She says, "Well, they'll be back there in a few minutes." She says, "Nelson wants me to come over. My husband isn't home. Do you mind if I come over?" Now, can you imagine a stranger coming into your house that you haven't washed the windows this week? You know, that was the way I was in those days. But I told her, "Please, would you?" before I even thought. And she came over. And our house was filled with people that night. They brought a big coffee pot over, and I don't know whether they had a meeting that night or not, but they did. He did get up off the bed and come into the living room and talk with them, and they did tell me there was a place down there for me, and they just were insisting on me coming, and I knew that they'd want me to come down there. You know, I figured that they would want to crown me queen for a day at least for how good I'd been. Letting my child go down there and taking care of this man and letting him go down there. They wanted to crown me. I assure you of that before it was over, because I didn't understand a thing about Al-Anon when I came in. And the next night we went to our first meeting, and of course I was going to go sit by him, and I had my shorthand notebook and my pencil, and I was going to take notes about what he had to do, because I wanted this man sober. And as soon as we got in the door, someone took me by the arm and said, "You go in here." And I looked, and he was going that way, and I thought, this will never do. He has the car keys. He'll escape. But wonder of wonders, I do not remember anything that happened that night. I truly don't remember much that happened, because I was spending my time looking back to see if he was going out that front door, and if he had, I would have flown out behind him. But when the meeting was over, I looked around, and he was sitting over the table talking to some men. He didn't pay attention to me, and he kept talking, and we were there about 1:30 before we went home. And that got to be the pattern of our life. There wasn't always a meeting for Al-Anon, but there was a meeting every night there for AA, and he went every night. But I still didn't trust him. I still thought I needed to be there, and I used all kinds of excuses. I would do things like give him time to get there, and I'd call the club. "Has Neil gotten there? I don't need to talk to him." You know, of course I didn't need to talk to him. I just needed to know. I was obsessed with knowing where he was. I said, "But tell him to bring some milk home." And I'd run in and pour the milk out so he would need some. I did all kinds of cute things. And they kept telling me, you know, to let go and let God. But I didn't marry that man to turn my back on him, and I really thought that was what that meant. I was too confused to understand. But at last my sponsor told me, he said, "Mary, why don't you try releasing him with love?" And I thought I was doing that. I mean, I really, by that time, realized that I had to work the program. He was still sober, and it was 6 or 7 weeks, and, you know, I was walking on air, but I kept thinking in the back of my mind, he'll show him. He's been sober 6 or 7 weeks before, and I really thought felt like this. And his big old sponsor, some of y'all might know him, Harold Duggan, backed me into a corner one day, and he said, "Don't they have a sign on your wall in there that says, 'Let go and let God'?" And I said, "I don't do it that way. I'm releasing him with love." And Harold can be hateful looking. And he looked at me and he says, "Why don't you try getting the hell off his back?" And that was my language. I understood what he meant. I really, at that time, I really knew that they meant for me to take my hands off and mind my own business. And when it did, it gave me an opportunity to really look at the Al-Anon program. Our child was in Alateen doing fine. Neil was in AA doing fine. And so I started trying to work the program. And I realized what it said when it was powerless. And I realized for the first time that I really was powerless over everything and everyone except myself. And I couldn't have taken that second step had I not looked at that third one. But after I looked at that second step and I thought, well, I've got to take that third one. I used to have all this faith, but I was still frightened inside. But I was beginning to feel as though I belonged, which was the first time in many years. And then one Sunday at an open meeting at the 710 Club there in Midland, where we went in, Gert Bahana was talking. Some of you have probably heard of Gert Bahana. And she was talking, and she was very, very old, and she was very, very beautiful. And it was 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and they have a round window, colored window up front of the podium, and the sun was shining in down onto her, and it just was one of those times when you get that a spiritual feeling. And Gert Bahana said that when she wanted to get in touch with her God, that she just raised her hands and she knew that he reached down and touched them. I had to sit on my hands. I felt like God had reached down and touched my hands. And I know I didn't see a burning bush, but I got that great feeling inside that I had when God was in my pocket. And it was one of the greatest moments of my life. I just, afterwards, I couldn't even tell anyone about it. I was so struck by what had happened and how I felt. And I wanted to go around with my hands in the air because I didn't want to lose this conscious contact with God. That I know from my 11th step that I have on a minute basis daily if I need it. Life went along well for us. We certainly didn't, I didn't get any blue ribbons in the program, but I tried. And we were transferred from there down to Pensacola, and there was just one. In the meantime, our child graduated from high school, and he broke my heart. I would have called the president if I reverted to how I used to be, but he didn't want to go to college, and we'd worked very hard and saved that child to go to college. And he also had a swimming scholarship for part payment. I don't want to go. He said, I want to go and get in the Army, and then when I come back, I'll go to college. And you know, y'all, you people had taught me that this is a young adult and that he's big enough to make his own decisions. And I think he made a wise decision. I mean, at the time we had to sign for him. He wasn't old enough. I didn't sign. Well, I would have signed for him, but his dad signed for him. And this is something I want to say real quick, that I have never seen any better relationship between a, quote, step-parent and a child. He adopted him, but they had a great love for one another. And this is another great blessing that I had from God, that they really loved one another. And you see, his dad signed for him, and he went in, and of course he went to Vietnam, and about that time we were transferred down to Pensacola. And these people held us up and helped us so many times, because it wasn't too long before we got one of those telegrams from the service that first that, you know, he was missing, and then that he had been hurt. They don't tell you how much, but you know, I had the consolation of knowing, and I was very grateful that they sent me a telegram and not someone to the door. So you people had taught me to be grateful, to look for something to be grateful for. And we had 17 days there that I don't believe without the program and the people in it that either of us would have gotten through. But he didn't find it necessary to take a drink, and I didn't find it necessary to collapse. We kept going to meetings. We went to Mobile to meetings. We went to Pascagoula. We went over to Eglin Air Base. They load up three or four cars, because there wasn't but two meetings two nights a week in Pensacola. And we'd load up three or four cars, and away we'd go to meetings. And for this, I will always love all of you, because we needed it. Because left to my own devices, I would have fallen onto that pity pot, and I don't know what would have happened. But the great day came when we got a call, and they told us that he was flying into Walter Reed, and that they'd like for some of us to meet him. And we discussed both of us going up, and my husband was very level-headed, and of course he wanted to see that child very, very badly. But he said, look, we can't afford a lot of trips up there. Why don't you go and come back, and in 2 weeks I'll go. And this is the way we worked it for the whole time he was there, which gave him company every other weekend, and yet about every other weekend, because we went once a month. But anyway, another great miracle happened to me when I went up there to see him. They took us out to the Andrews Air Force Base 4 o'clock in the morning. I'd gotten in at 11 at night, and at 4 o'clock in the morning, they took us out in buses to meet the planes when they came in. And they told us all where to stand. And I looked and looked, and I never did see mine. And what saw me through then was, right before the planes landed, there was three of them, right before those planes landed, they called some names out for them to go to the chaplain. And you know, we all knew what had happened there. We knew that they had expired on the way. And see, thank God, my name was not called. But I didn't see my child. And I saw people, you know, they walked off on crutches, and I saw a few stretchers down there. And there was three or four of us that didn't find our kids. But we went on back. They took us back to Walter Reed Hospital, and they said, oh, he's going into surgery this morning, and that's the reason you didn't see him, and he won't be out of surgery till 11 or something. I forget what time they said, but I had some time that there wasn't anything I could do, but the only way I could go see him around 1 o'clock, and so I went up around 1 o'clock, and they said, oh, well, Warren said, he's from Texas, and I said, yes, said, well, he's had company. And they were just delighted that someone was there. And they said, there was a man in here from Texas to see him just a few minutes ago. Said, but the doctors are with him right now. Said, he's getting along just fine. And that's when they told me they had amputated his leg. Well, you know, this, before the program, I would have probably just fainted, but I think I was in a state of shock. And then I was still nosy about who from Midland had been in to see him. But when I walked up to this child's bed, and he was a child, he was just 18 then, he had in his hand, and I know it was a hard time for him too, but he had in his hand a card with all the meetings in Midland, Texas on it. And on the other side of it, it had, "Father, we thank you for all you've given us, for all you've taken from us, and all that is left." And this made me grateful. He had a good leg. It looked like his mind was good. He had both of his arms. He had a little smile on his face. You know, I had a lot to be grateful for, and this is what you people had taught me. This is the program at work. You know, sometimes we don't know we have the program until such a time as we really need it. And I found it very automatic to count my blessings standing there by this young man's bed. And I stayed up there for about a week and came back, and then his dad went up, and I made one more trip, and then he came home, and things got better, and we accepted. But one of the things I'm very grateful to this program for is the Alatine that he had helped him to accept. And he has accepted, I think, beautifully. He's a young man. He's a state police officer. He has two kids. He leads a normal life. In fact, he's too busy. He doesn't always do what I want him to, but I'm proud of him. And life went along real well, and we were in and out of Pensacola, and God blessed us in getting us to go and meet people all over. And it was a great life, and we enjoyed it. Now, I don't mean that we never had any problems, but we didn't have any major problems. God saw to it that we had what we needed when we needed it, and he still does with me. But then we got along to a spot, and man, we kept trying to find us a church. Now, this is a spiritual program, and we were using it completely. And this is fine. I did it for years. I felt very close to my God. When I wanted him, he was right there. He saw me through many things. And we would go to one church, and it wasn't the church's fault. We wouldn't like this. We wouldn't like that. We didn't feel comfortable. We'd get that disease of dis-ease again, and we wouldn't go back. And one Sunday morning, we had had breakfast, and Neil came running down the hall and took the phone book and started looking in it, and I heard him make a call. But, you know, I didn't even listen to see who was calling. See how I've grown? I used to, when he got the book, who you going to call? What are you going to call him for? What are you going to say to him? But I really didn't pay him much attention. He stuck his head back there while I was washing dishes, and he said, "Can you be ready to go to church in about 15 minutes? Well, I could be ready to go to a wedding in 15 minutes, you know. And this delighted me that we were going to go to church, because deep in my heart, I had always wanted to go to church. You know, I always wanted a structured church to go to. We don't have to have it, but I wanted one. And we went to this church. It was Unity Church. We both liked it. We saw a lot of people from AA there. And we started going to that church regularly, and we went every Sunday. But now we still, of course, went to our meetings, and life was going along beautifully. Then it came Mother's Day, and normally on Mother's Day and Easter and Christmas, we went to church with our kids. We were those kind of people at that time. But my daughter-in-law called, and she says, "Mom, this year it's Mother's Day, and let's us go to y'all's church this time, instead of y'all to ours." And I thought that was nice. So we all went to church over there. And the oldest grandson, Dusty, who is practically my heart, I love my other one dearly, but he's just like his dad was. And Dusty liked what he saw. I think what he saw was a couple of little girls, but you know, it didn't matter. Whatever he liked, he wanted to go to church with us, and we started picking him up. Now, his parents insisted on him going to Mass before, but he would be ready, and we'd pick him up, and he'd go to church with us. And Neil became an usher, and I was so proud when I would see him being an usher in that church. And time rocks along, and one Sunday on the way to church, Dusty was very excited. He said, "I'm going to get to usher today. The youth of church were going to be the ushers." And he says, "I have the center row." And this is when you get to take the collection basket and everything. And I was pleased for him. You know, we like to see these things happening to our grandkids too. But when he got there, the one that was supposed to help him couldn't. And he came running, and they told him, said, well, get someone else to help you. And he went out and got Honey, because that was what he called his grandfather, Honey. He came down there that day. He says, Honey, John didn't show up. Said, would you help me usher? And I know, too, that he needed this support from his grandfather to do the job. That church would hardly contain my heart and my pride. Grandfather and grandson doing their duty for the church and for God. And I remember that they were standing down there when they brought the money back, and I saw Neil put that big old arm up across Dusty's shoulder, and I could just hardly contain myself. I sat there and cried. I was so happy. And I know now that God gave me this memory, because the next Sunday, my husband had died with a heart attack. And I can look back on that, and I can be so happy right now thinking of how great it was to see grandfather and grandson doing their duty to God. And God knew that Mary would need this memory. And it makes me very happy at this point to think of that. It was a great shock, and the program saw me through a lot of it. And don't let people fool you. The program helps you no matter how you act. Because I know I didn't act well all the time. I know that there was times I just couldn't go to a meeting. They brought meetings to me. They talked to me on the phone. And I started realizing that God was doing for me so many things I could not do for myself. I had a young attorney knock on my door and say, within 3 weeks after Neil died, and I hadn't even thought about what I was going to do. I hadn't gotten that far along. And said, Mary, I don't know what you're going to do, or whether you want to or not. Said, but I wish you'd try coming and working for me a while. And that was a job. And it gave me a reason to get up in the morning. And it was a very challenging job. And I could stay there from 7 in the morning till 10 at night if my energy held out. And it did lots of times. And this was the way I existed for a while, until such a time as I could get back on the right track of doing the things that I'm supposed to do. I know that God is always going to give me what I need when I need it, as long as I let him. I feel like I belong. I don't have any more of that disease. I try to be a truthful person, and I try my best to help someone each day if I can. And people do help me daily on a basis. I will never be able to explain to anyone the love that I have for this program, because I had no love for anyone when I came in. I suppose I had an attraction for my husband, and I know that I loved him, and I know I love my child. But I have a deep love for lots of people at this time. That callous was gone from my heart within 2 years after, but it took that long. On a daily basis, I get up in the morning and I ask God to see me through the day, and if it be his will for me to help someone, to let me help them, and for me to take life just like it comes out of that pipe, because it isn't the things that happen in life that are going to determine how Mary's day and life is going to be. It's how I react to it. And this is what Al-Anon has taught me, is I don't have to react. I don't have to be a people pleaser. I don't have to have everything in the world. You know, I like that when they say, if you don't have what you want what you have. I like that. I have a happy life. It isn't like I planned it. And some good comes out of everything, they tell us. I no longer feel alone. I went through this spell after my husband died of feeling alone. I could see a couple coming into a meeting room and I wanted to get up and leave. I felt, now this is crazy, but this is the way I felt. I felt rejected. I felt rejected by him. I felt rejected by y'all. But this was something I had to work out through the fourth step, and I did. God gives me what I need on a daily basis as I need it. And I don't have to worry about tomorrow. I don't have to worry about all those crazy, dishonest things I did before. All I've got to do is try to keep Mary in touch with God today and allow him to work through my life on a daily basis. I thank you all for listening to me, and I would like to close with my very favorite prayer. Father, we thank you for all you've given us, for all you've taken from us, and all that is left. Thank you.